should you be bigger?
We are in the big bulker segment.
The majority of the world's goods are still being transported on ships, and that's because it's low cost and low CO2 emitting.
Our ships are larger, and that means we are essentially, kind of industry language, lowest on the cost curve.
Well, it could be some sort of a Glasgow meeting endgame. Our guest today is an ex-broker who stepped up to the C-suite. He's the founder, he's the former chairman, he's the current CEO of an Oslo-listed global shipping company. He also has another job, he's the chairman of an exciting esports company, but he's not here today to talk about that. He is here to tell us all about 2020 Bulkers. Welcome to the Arctic Podcast Studio, Magnus Halvorsen.
Thank you, Gaute.
So let's start with some really basic questions. Not really questions, but just actually know this. How many boats do you have, Magnus?
We have 8 very modern dry bulk vessels, so-called Newcastle Max ships.
Isn't that a little bit like a small number? Should you be bigger?
No, we actually, and we might be a bit different. We don't care how many ships we are. We care about how much equity return we can generate for our investors. And I think having more ships doesn't make us happy, and it doesn't make our investors more happy. And we are actually probably one of the few companies you'll have here that that will tell you we have no growth ambitions. We think that's quite key in surviving in our business, which is highly cyclical. There's a few times you have to invest, and or you should invest, and other times you should really just focus on running the assets as well as possible and paying out cash.
Fascinating. But okay, let's talk through that. So let's start with the name, I guess. 2020, that's obviously last year. Are you last year's story, or what happened there? What was the name? What was the reason for the name?
No, I mean, I wish you didn't ask that question. It's probably the poorest name you'll have in your studio. When we set the company up, we everything happened quite quickly, and I had a lawyer on the phone, and he asked, what's the company going to be called? And I just had to come up with something. In hindsight, we could say it's 2020 Vision or some things like that, but yeah, it is what it is.
So all your 8 Newcastle Max boats were delivered in 2020 or thereabouts, or
we got the first ship delivered in August 2019, and we got our last ship of the 8 delivered in June 2020. So we have a little bit more than a year of full fleet operating.
And you ordered when did you order these boats? It was around 17-18.
We ordered in August September 2017, which was actually, we think, the cheapest price that these type of Newcastlemax vessels have ever been contracted from the yards. So it was a good entry point.
How much did you pay per vessel?
We paid, including, I guess, all associated project costs, just under $47
million. $47 million. And today, your stock is at around 107, so that's around $12. And there's about 22 million shares outstanding. And you have a little bit of debt, so you're at around an enterprise value of $480 million. So you're at around $60 million per vessel. Do you agree with those numbers, sort of roughly?
Yeah, roughly.
And so that begs the question then. You say you ordered at 47 and you're trading at 60, so is that a sell? Stupid question, but
no, I think there's two things that's worth mentioning. One is we have actually paid out a lot of the equity back to the shareholders already. So though we just had a bit more than a year of full operating, we have paid back 38% of the equity that was put into the company. So you have to factor that in. And then, of course, it's a cyclical market where these type of ships, which we contracted for 47 at the peak back in 08, 09, they were maybe worth as a resale 170, 180 million.
Wow.
So in that context, 60, as you say, is probably not expensive. Another data point, if you will, is if you were to start Gaute Bulkers today and,
yes,
and you were to go to the shipyard.
I should.
And you hadn't placed the orders yet. I mean, I think best case, you could get 8 ships delivered by the end of 2024. If you went to all the Chinese yards that are building them, if you wanted everyone's sister vessels as we have, you would be into 2025. And it would cost you probably around $67 million.
So $67 million 3 years out. So that doesn't sound great.
And you would, of course, have to start putting in equity right away.
Of
so you would have some, I guess money not really giving you return for a while, whereas we are on the water and generating cash flow every day, and we pay it back also quite frequently.
Perfect segue to my next question, which is, of course, then what do you do with your money that you make? And I may give you a compliment straight away. I think you have a very modern dividend policy.
Yeah, well, it is actually a very simple policy, and it really goes back to, how do you survive, in our view, in shipping? Is you have to be extremely disciplined. You know, you of course have to buy when assets are cheap, simply speaking. But then there comes a point where hopefully you start making some good cash flows. And we think then the key is not to chase the market by ordering these more expensive new builds or buying more expensive secondhand ships. And of course, new builds, as we talked about, would deliver out in time, which, you know, is not great for equity returns in the short term. And then you have to resist the temptation that when ships cost $47 million, very few people want to buy ships, very few people want to co-invest with equity, and the banks are not really that keen to support you either. Of course, as the cycle progresses, you know, equity investors are willing to fund you because they see the good returns here and now, and the banks become a lot looser. I mean, these days we're actually getting inbound requests from banks we don't know who want to finance ships. So I think the key, as we kind of said, if we're going to do this, we are investing and we set this company up as investors, not because we wanted to have a shipping company or call ourselves ship owners. And we said, you know, at this price, historically, it's a very good risk reward. We also looked at historical cycles because, I mean, shipping in public markets has not been a good place to be a long-term investor. I think if you bought at the previous low in 2002, 2003, you would have had a good run. But then, you know, most of those companies have been restructured and had to issue equity. And I guess the return by holding had been quite horrible. And we looked at this. So what if you just ordered ships, paying at the time 34 for a slightly smaller vessel? That ship up until today would have given you 170 million in EBITDA, so sort of unlevered cash flow, and you still have a scrap value of 15. So it's not that it's an asset that doesn't give return, but it's an asset that can kill you if you have the wrong capital structure and you don't stop investing. So we said we start this company with what we think were the best assets at the time and probably still is. Among what's on the water. And then we said we just harvest it as it delivers. So every month we pay out the free cash flow after debt service. So free cash flow to us, it's G&A, OPEX, debt amortization and interest. Everything that's left after that line, we pay out. And as I said, we paid out 38% of what was put in so far. And I think if you look...
But how did you come up with the monthly thing? Was that because it's not normal? I think quarterly is a very sort of American thing, but I have seen half yearly, but monthly is very modern.
Yeah, no, I guess you could say that. But if you know you're not going to keep the money to reinvest it, why not pay it out as soon as possible? I think our shareholders value that kind of frequent cash flow. We get a lot of positive feedback on it, both from institutions and also private shareholders. So it's a model that works for us, and we can do it because we have a very, very simple structure where we essentially know what our costs are month to month. They don't change. We report every month what we've earned for that month, and then comes the dividend. So September, for instance, we paid out 39 cents per share, which of course is going to vary month to month. But if you annualize just that month, that's a 37% yield on today's share price. People like to get it sooner than later. I mean, if Arctic came and told you would get a quarterly salary, you probably wouldn't be so happy.
I like monthly. But then actually I checked and there is one Swedish company called Cibus Nordic Real Estate. They were the first in Sweden and first in the Nordics to pay monthly dividends. And I think they've had a very good stock run. And then there's another Swedish company, SBB, led by this larger than life Dr. Ilya Batljan. He, I think, copied you. So he recently started to pay the monthly dividend. But it's funny because the Swedish newspapers have picked up on this, and there's been a big article in Dagens Industri encouraging the banks to pay monthly, because and there was some article saying that, you know, most people, they have a monthly interest to pay on their mortgages, and if you then had an option to buy shares in a bank and get a monthly dividend, that, you know, you could sort of offset that and you could create more sort of a folkaktie. And then there was a very funny comment that I also saw in last week's Affärsvärlden, which is this weekly Swedish magazine, saying paying dividends once per year feels obsolete. To show that you're involved, you must at least consider splitting up the dividend. Half year is a first step, but already next year, a lot of shares will go over to monthly payments, because you know what matters on the stock exchange? Money always before intelligence.
Yeah, well, I like to think that our investors have, that we give them some money and they have intelligence. But yeah, again, frequent cash flows is better than rare cash flows.
We like the monthly cash flows. Now, we should maybe then look into the underlying market, because I guess we have only touched upon the stock specific so far, but they are very tightly together, as obviously evident from the fact that you pay out everything. So starting off, you have provided a slide. Yeah, well, you touched upon this already. You said that you had your September annualized dividend yield was in the 30% range. And
high 30.
High 30.
37.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm being modest. I'm sorry. And now... let's look into 2022 then, because that's only a few months down the line. And so you have a slide on that as well. You say our dividend potential is significant, and you've given a 2022 indicative dividend capacity in NOK, kindly. And interestingly, I checked. So the Arctic analyst, Lars Bastian, he's estimating $32,000 for the Capesize segment that you're in. You can maybe elaborate a little bit on the difference between the Capesize and the Newcastle Max. But interestingly, that would yield more than 29 NOK per share. You've given 30,000 gives 29 NOK per share. So, yeah, I guess a couple of questions. A, it's a bit of a volatile market. So I guess we're, you know, that's why we have to sort of average a little bit here. So maybe you can elaborate a little bit on sort of the peaks and the troughs of the market since you became, you know, a shipping CEO.
Yeah, I guess you brought up one question first, which I should add in terms of understanding our company. So we are in the big bulker segment.
Bigger than Capesize.
Bigger than Capesize. But we do compete with Capesize. And I guess Capesize, as the legacy vessel, 180,000 deadweight tons, is the workhorse in our market. Our ships are larger. They have a cargo intake of 208,000 deadweight tons. And because we have modern ships, we're obviously more fuel efficient than the average ship we compete with. So if you are an investor wanting to follow the market and try to understand where we fit in, we get the premium because of larger cargo intake and lower fuel consumption than the average vessel. And we have contracts, which all of them are actually what we call index-linked contracts, meaning we get the daily Capesize rate, which is published by the Baltic Exchange, plus a premium. Currently, that premium across our fleet is around 35%. On top of that, we also get a premium for the fuel savings that we get from our scrubbers, the ability to burn HFO rather than low sulfur fuel. And that, you can add, depends on the spreads, but around $2,000 per day. And I think it's a bit important as well, because we like to talk about the upside and our ability to pay dividends. But the fact that we have a low cost structure to begin with, we have a low G&A, we're only four people in the company, although we have some very experienced people in the company. And we also have what we think is very reasonable debt financing. Means we need $14,500 to break even.
$14,500. That's the lowest level. And what's the lowest level the Capesize market has been this year?
Yeah, but just to get to so $14,500, that's what we need. But given the premiums that I just talked about, we achieve that as long as the Capesize market is $10,000 a day.
Exactly.
And that means we are essentially, if you think about it in kind of industry language, lowest on the cost curve, the way we see it. And that, of course, helps when markets are bad. You know, in this period when we had COVID, you had a rough market, and that extra premium helped us. And I think that brings me into another thing. You know, what's the market been like since we started? Well, we obviously set up the company because we were constructive on the market, and we still are. And that was very much the case coming into 2020. We had two of our ships on fixed rates, and we had six open. And then COVID hit. And of course, you know, as in most other priced markets, rates went very low. Spot rates for Capesize went all the way to 3,000, which means there's not a ship owner in the world that even covers OPEX.
But that was in the trough of COVID, so that's 2020.
Yeah, but you asked about the markets we've seen, and I'll just tell people how we handled that. Then we were able to take advantage of a great tool we have through our charters. We have floating charters, but we also have the right to convert them at any point in time to fixed rates for a period of 3 months or more. And that's done on the basis of the forward curve in the market, the so-called FFA market. And in the Capesize market, just like any other commodity market, when spot prices crash because of a sort of short-term disruption, the market tends to be in contango. So what we did last year, we converted then, so we went from two ships on fixed to six on fixed, mm-hmm. and essentially covered all our fixed costs for the year and ensured that we would not bleed cash at the time when the world was looking highly uncertain. And that we were only able to do as a combination of a low cash break-even, the premium we get, and the ability to convert these charters, which I think we're quite unique in having across the fleet. And I think it's something that, of course, no one buys a shipping company not to lose money. But on the other hand, in a cyclical market, you need to make sure that you survive in the bad times. Last year, we didn't make a lot of money, but we made positive net profit every quarter. And you are good at researching things. I've tried. I haven't seen any other dry bulk company listed anywhere in the world that had a positive net profit each quarter in 2020. And that's something we're quite proud of.
No, I think that very few shipping companies across industries were profitable all quarters last year. It was obviously quite extraordinary. But then a little bit sort of, you know, year is normal. But how is 2021 then looking? Because, I mean, I'm looking at some very long-term graphs here. You mentioned the sort of spike we had in, well, between 2000 and 2008, the market was good, and then it spiked in 2008, and then obviously it's been quite terrible since, up until this year.
Yeah, I mean, the market's been very good in 2021. I think in December last year, the forward market, or the FFA market, you could buy as a financial investor Capesize rates at 14,000 a day up until December, basically a year ago. Now we're sitting here in November, and year to date rates have been 33,000 a day.
33
for standard Capesize, and yeah, it's the best in quite some time. But there's obviously been a lot of volatility in that period. You've had just over a month ago, you had standard Capesize rates breaking 80,000 a day. They've now corrected down to just under 30, which is still very good levels. And I guess the kind of million-dollar question is, you know, why is the market now better than in 10 years, and can it last? One thing we don't do and will never do is to try to give short-term guidance and predicting rates, because it's
super volatile.
One thing it's volatile, but it's also depending on lots of micro factors that you really can't foresee. I mean, if a major port has a couple of weeks with lower exports because of whatever reason, if there are weather disruptions, inefficiencies going up and down, that can dictate the market. There's also a lot of psychology. But longer term, I at least think there's a few things you should look at if you're trying to make sense of a market. The most important thing in shipping, if you only had one indicator you could choose, in my mind, is to look at the supply side. And why do I say that? Because you look at this hugely volatile market price-wise, and you might say, well, I mean, here demand must be going up and down all over the place. How can you make anything out of it? The fact for dry bulk as a whole, if you take all segments, it's actually a market that's grown 28 of the last 30 years, and it's grown by an average of 4%. So,
which is probably GDP.
It's and really that's what it is. It's a GDP plus game.
Exactly.
Because, you know, more people consume more goods, they need more houses to live in, they need more motorways. And that's why you have that relatively stable demand side. It's the supply side and the lack of discipline in the industry that really creates the big problems. And to give you some reference points, we had the fantastic boom market in shipping from 04 to 09. And people were ordering ships like there was no tomorrow. So at the peak, you had an order book of 120%. So really meaning that there were 1.2 times as many ships on order compared to what was on the water.
What could possibly go wrong there?
Or you could ask the other way, how could that possibly go right? No market can handle that when you get that kind of supply growth over 2 to 3 years. And that's really what created this 10-year depression, if you will. You know, we had to work through this overhang. Historically, it's been an interesting time to look at shipping when the order book approaches 15%, which is really where we were when we ordered the ships. So for us,
how long does a typical ship last? I know that depends on a number of factors, including technology shifts. But would you say is the average lifetime of a ship?
I mean, the depreciated lifetime and I guess the useful life is 25 years. In reality, a dry bulk vessel scraps at 22 years on average, okay, if you look historically.
So 45% scrap per year,
yes,
on average.
Exactly, which means you need to have an order book to replace ships that are retiring and also to handle the growth. And what's happened in a way, certain things about this market looks better than when we started. We started when the order book was 15%, and it's now down to the lowest level I think we've seen ever for dry bulk. The dry bulk order book is 6%, and the Capesize order book is pretty much the same. It's 6.5% or so.
And you mentioned earlier on that Goethe bulkers cannot get any boats on the water until 2024.
Correct. And we have been a bit lucky in the bulker market because post-COVID, there was a massive surge, which is still ongoing, by the way, in the container market, which has led to a significant amount of orders. And that is really what has blocked up a lot of the yard capacity.
In addition, I guess a lot of the yards went bust.
A lot of the yards went bust. I mean, in the boom times, you were taking orders for yards that didn't even exist. And a lot of them never were able to produce proper ships. But there was another thing, which was... today, you don't really build bulkers in Korea, but if you look at the big shipbuilding nations, Korea and China in particular, if Goethe Bulkers wants to start a new company and order ship for 47 million and start paying cash, you want to guarantee that the ship gets finished or you get your cash back. That's called a refund guarantee.
Mm-hmm.
And these are essentially given by banks that are state controlled. And when a lot of these projects went wrong, either because yards couldn't finish ships or because owners had ordered at high levels and couldn't take delivery at the end, someone is left with that bill having to pay out the refund guarantees. So there's been a rationalization of the shipbuilding industry by capacity is one, but also in terms of how it's being supported. So in China, for instance, the state-owned enterprises have been combined to one yard group, which is sort of centrally controlled. And particularly for bigger ships, I would say there's a handful of yards that are getting credit support and are able to then do contracts. And a lot of the capacity is also reduced. And I'm not, capacity in every industry is dynamic. Of course, if we have a couple of good years, if prices go up, if the yards make money, and demand is there, I'm sure there will be more capacity. But a lot of time people say, well, isn't there just a lot of yards there that can just, you know, restart again? And I have, and for anyone who's traveled around China in the regions where there are lots of shipyards, you will know that a lot of the yards are gone. I mean, the cranes are taking down, the areas have been rezoned for recreational use, for building apartment blocks, etc. So of course, there can be a supply side response at one point when it comes to yard capacity, but it cannot happen in the next couple of years. So I think we have a runway now, at least through 2024, and really that's only because that's how far we're seeing scarce demand and scarcity for orders.
That's because in 2024, Ghetto Bulkers comes to the market with all those new ships.
Exactly. But we have a couple of years where, I mean, even if all the banks came with free money and Arctic were...
I found a lot of investors that were willing to, fund Ghetto Bulkers, which I don't think, but let's...
Even if you did, you couldn't get your ship. That's the thing. So...
There's another thing that we need to touch upon as well. This whole ESG and CO2 topic. Mm-hmm. Because I think that obviously very important with the shipyards, etc. But there seems also to be quite a lot of discussions just on fuel and, I guess, engine technology. You mentioned scrubbers. Arctic has been involved in raising money for Himalaya Shipping as well, which is obviously some of the same people that were involved in 2020 Bulkers, Olav Trøim, etc. They were going for dual fuel, which is LNG. So how is this, Magnus, what is your sort of big picture on how is this impacting the dry bulk market?
I mean, there is something coming. And if you look on a high level, the IMO, which is a UN body, essentially creating all the rules and regulations for what goes on in international shipping, they have a target to reduce CO2 emissions from shipping with 40% from a 2008 baseline by 2030. And as a consequence of that, they have come out with a proposal last year, which will be implemented on January 1st, 2023. It's actually two sets of regulations, one called EEXI and one called CII. And these are, I guess, measurements that limit the amount of CO2 you can emit per voyage, per ton transported.
And all the big nations agree on this? So China is on this and Brazil, Australia, the people that didn't agree on this?
Yes, and this, I mean, it's not really a debate now, but I think that when the proposal first came up, where Norway and Japan, some other nations were some of the signatories on the proposal, essentially everyone supported it, even the people you might suspect wouldn't. So, I mean, yes, China supported it, Greece supported it, and it will be implemented. And I think... Then you have to look at, so what does this actually mean? What will it do to existing ships? If you have a ship that's non-compliant, you are left with a few options. One is you can try to do performance-enhancing measures. You know, you could change the propeller, you could try anti-fouling paint, things like that. That doesn't move the needle at all. So it doesn't really help. I think what will be the default solution for most people with the problem, if you will, it's what's called an energy performance limitation. That is not the same as a speed limit. A speed limit was discussed because obviously if the whole fleet slows down, you're going to emit less CO2. The problem with the speed limit is the inefficient ship gets to run as fast as the efficient ship. So you're not really incentivizing people to invest in more modern equipment, and you're not really penalizing the less efficient ship. So the EPL is essentially a cap on the RPM at the level where you'll meet the requirements. And the consequence of that will be that the less efficient ship will have to go slower.
So you are forcing slow steaming on older vessels?
Yes, essentially you are. And
then do you make even more money then because you have the most modern vessels? Will you be paid like an efficiency premium?
I think we have to see because this is developing, but I think the things that will happen, there's no doubt that the average speed of the fleet, the average trading speed, will go down. And that's
everything
good.
And everything else equal, then of course rates goes up because assuming the same amount of goods need to be.
Yeah, so that reduces effective supply. And that will happen. Unfortunately, it's quite tricky to quantify how much, because it's very, very individual depending on the different ship, their fuel speed and consumption characteristic, etc. But you know, just directionally, it's going to be a positive. I think that there will be a pricing differential in the market. Of course, a ship that can go quicker, doing a spot voyage, getting paid the same dollar per ton, will have a higher economic value to the charter. For index contracts, I don't think that anyone has done contracts where that's reflected yet, because it's a bit too early, and I think people are kind of waiting to see how it plays in. But it's the same logic as our the premium we get compared to a standard ship because of lower fuel consumption. And then we'll see. I mean, it's something being talked a lot about these days. But it's not something that's in effect. But if there will be a global carbon tax for shipping,
well, it could be some sort of a Glasgow meeting endgame, I guess, or maybe this is something that it's coming in the next couple of years.
Yeah, and of course that would also penalize the older ships. So I think directionally the fleet will go slower. It will be worse for the older ships. They will have less commercial value. And it may also lead to some accelerated scrapping at one point. And when the IMO put this proposal out, and if you go back and read the white paper, it's actually one of the three alternatives they mention, is what can you do as an owner that don't comply? Alternative three, buy a new ship.
Right.
So it's not like they came up with the proposal and didn't think about the consequences. I think they want to promote renewal. And of course, we are old technology in the sense that we are still running on bunker oil, but we've had an assessment with our classing company, and we believe, based on what they're saying, that we are in the top 8% percentile of ships on water.
We should maybe add that shipping is, of course, extremely environmentally friendly compared to, for example, air freight, and of course, it's the most sort of. It's the bulk. It's the majority of the world's goods are still being transported on ships, and that's because it's low cost and low CO2 emitting relative to, for example, air freight.
Very much so. It's the number is actually around 90% of all goods travel on a ship, and shipping represents less than 4% of global CO2 emissions.
Wow. Yeah.
So it is a very environmentally friendly way of transporting goods.
That's an excellent end to that part. We are rounding off. I just want to touch upon your journey. Obviously, I think it's quite clear that you've been a financially oriented person. You've been with Pareto, you've been with Plato, some of our friendly competitors. Can I just ask, sort of, what's the best part about being? I guess you're not even on the buy side. You're on the corporate, on the issuer side. What's the best parts? Then you know, aside from coming to the Arctic podcast.
Aside from that, that's tough to beat. So I have to think hard now. No, I mean it's been fun building a company, and we haven't been many people, but both the people on the investor side and the people who are doing the day-to-day operation, etc. We're a small team, and I think the fact that a small team can build a company that can become accepted as a very good supplier with services. I mean, we are dealing with some of the largest and highest quality companies in the world in each their business. We have Glencore as one client. We have six ships with Koch Industries. And I think if you look at...
Koch is probably the world's largest privately held company or something like that.
I believe it is. I mean, and I don't think they published numbers, but there was a book out by Charles Koch, I think in 2014, where he gave out some numbers. And I think from he took over the company in the mid-60s, he outperformed the equity creation 27 times on the S&P. Mm-hmm. And they are extremely good business people. They're nice to work with. And the fact that we're building such good relationships that they actually chose to invest in our company as well. I mean, that's some of the big endorsements. And of course, it's also a bit fun to come in. I had been around shipping on the banking side and also investing in shipping. I hadn't run a shipping company, but that means you also question how some things are done. And I think we're quite proud on what we did on the commercial side. We have gotten premiums for our ships, which hadn't been achieved by anyone, to my knowledge, before. And that was really by taking a very financial mathematical approach to what are these ships were compared to the benchmark ship, if you will, a standard Capesize, and pushing and making sure we got paid an appropriate premium. And I guess challenging some people who were saying, well, you should do this because that's what the other guy did and that's how it's always been done.
I appreciate that very much. And I also want to applaud the fact that you have obviously quite very good and open slides, and you're sort of showing your numbers all the time. You're showing the sensitivities and, of course, paying out the monthly dividend. I mean, there's nowhere to hide.
There's nowhere to hide, and we will keep on being transparent whether the market goes up or down. And we've actually, to make life easier for shareholders, we've set up a Twitter account.
Yes, I was going to mention that. You didn't have a Twitter account when you were a broker. This is something that you started with when you became a CEO.
No, I'm not even on Facebook or Instagram or whatever is being used. But because we have a very transparent structure, like the Capesize rate plus a premium, less cash break even is what you get out. And then a lot of people are saying, well, how do we see these rates? And of course, if you're an Arctic client, you can get the report, but a lot of retail investors and others can't. So we have a Twitter account where we put out the market update every day. We say what the market is today. We tell them what it's been month to date, year to date, and we compare that to some other period. So that's at least to try to make educated investment decisions easier for people.
Super high transparency. We applaud that. Thank you very much, Magnus Halvorsen, for coming to the Arctic Podcast Studio. We'll be back next week with another exciting guest. Maybe a little bit more on the ESG topic then, but so far, so good. Thank you very much, Magnus.
Thank you, Gatte.
This podcast has been prepared by Arctic for information purposes only. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at your own risk. This podcast should not be considered professional advice. The information provided in this podcast is not intended to constitute investment advice, nor is the information intended as an offer or solicitation for the purchase or sale of any financial instrument. Relevant and specific professional advice should always be obtained before making any investment or credit decision. It is important to note that past performance is not indicative of future results. This podcast does not fulfill the criteria for preparing investment research and must be seen as marketing material. All information submitted during this podcast is obtained from public sources that Arctic believes to be reliable, but which Arctic has not independently verified. Arctic makes no guarantee, representation, or warranty as to its accuracy or completeness. No liability whatsoever is accepted for any direct or indirect, including consequential, loss or expense arising from the use of information from this podcast.